Art Mark, are you? Okay, great. Hi, everyone. So we'll start with introductions and welcome. Welcome. My name is Manuel Vasquez, and I'm the HIV Housing Programs Manager with the Mayor's Office of Housing, and I am Council Affairs Co-Chair. I will pass it to Nolly.
Everyone, Nolly with Marin County Council member and co-chair-ish for this
Awesome.
group.
Why don't we move to Matt Geltmaker?
And Matt Geltmaker, council member.
Thomas Noble?
Thomas Noble, they, them pronouns, government co-chair.
Maria Lacayo?
Maria Lacayo, she, her, and I'm a HIV Health Services employee participant.
Awesome. Sharon Pipkin?
Hi everyone, my name's Sharon Pipkin. My pronouns are she, her, and I'm here representing HIV surveillance, HIV epidemiology unit of San Francisco Department of Public Health.
Awesome. Welcome. Elise Griffin.
Hi everyone, good afternoon. I'm Elise Griffin. I'm a council member and also a DPH employee, currently stationed at Sacramento.
Great. Thank you. Bill Bloom.
Hi, Bill Bloom, HIV Health Services.
Great. Kat Tajir.
Tap Tap Gear, council staff.
Kira.
Kira, council staff.
And last but not least, Mark Molnar.
Mark Moore, council staff.
Great. Thanks, everyone, again, and welcome. Why don't we pull up the draft agenda for today? Okay. Does anyone have any questions or any additions before we go to vote? No. Okay. Seeing none, I'm going to pass it by consensus. Awesome. We'll move to the minutes from August 13th. Thank you, Kara. These are the minutes. Does anybody have any questions before we move to approve? No? Okay. Moving to approve it by consensus. Great. Okay. Announcements. Anyone have any announcements? No. Okay. Public comment. Any public comment? Nope. Okay. Now we're going to move to resource allocation vote. Mark Molnar.
All right. So before I share screen, just a bit of a explanation of this. This is one of our mandated activities. It is indeed the reason why councils were formed, which were to direct the use of funds, which are called resources. The council is mandated to provide potential scenarios for reduced funding, for flat funding, and for increased funding. Funding does need to fall within the 75-25 mandate. That means 75% must go to core medical services or medically associated services, and 25% to support services. If the EMA or TGA in question does have other funding that does allow support for core medical services, thereby not actually needing to spend 75%, a waiver can be requested and has certainly been requested by this EMA in past years. So with that said, we can start the discussion by looking at what the council determined as its allocation motions for last year. Now, this is just what was determined last year. This does not mean that you all would have to deliver the same resource allocation scenarios. It's just the beginning of the conversation. In San Francisco, we use what I've been referring to as a traveling motions process, in which the first committee on the calendar actually is the first conversation starter and scenario developer. And so you'll look at these, come up with allocation scenarios, and then it will go on to the next occurring committee, which tomorrow would be community engagement, and then after that it would go to membership, and then to steering, and then by the time the actual allocation and prioritization meeting occurs at the end of this month, you will have a motion that has been viewed hopefully by a majority of council members and all committees with motions on the floor for reduced, flat, and increased funding. So before I share screen, any questions on this process? No? All right, let's just jump into it then.
Thanks for the overview, though, Mark. That was helpful.
My pleasure. All right. Do you all see this?
Yes.
All right. So we're going to do these one at a time. The first motion that was approved last year was for increased funding. It was a pretty straightforward motion. And it read, if increased funding occurs, service category resource allocation will be increased proportionally across all categories. Of course, the logic behind this being if San Francisco does receive additional funds, then all service categories and therefore all service providing agencies would be able to share in that increase proportionally. All right, so this is what occurred last year. Certainly no need to follow it if you don't want to, or you can. The discussion is now open. Does not appear to be any discussion for this scenario. Mr. Thomas? Noble.
You know, I'm not sure if, and I'm just more asking folks, care dollars versus prevention dollars. I don't know if new member, like I think people, new members might not quite understand that differentiation. So I'm wondering if it's worth just kind of spelling that out in the title or something.
Sure, but yeah, I can absolutely do that. We can actually add that. But, you know, we do go over what the different funding streams are during orientation training. So hopefully this wouldn't be too perplexing. But, yeah, certainly. Yes, Matt.
So I know this is my billionth time of doing this. I'm just wondering, did we ever have a discussion about, because we have for the decreased funding, you know, we have where the reductions come from the service categories a part of the essential health benefits. Was there ever any discussion did we have around increased funding? And I'm not advocating one way or the other, but just a discussion about for increased funding, doing kind of the reverse where we for like the first 10% of the increase would go or like to the service categories that are not part of essential benefits. Or is that just kind of a lot of crazy making bookkeeping that really isn't worthwhile? Bill, maybe.
I'll let Bill answer that second question. But as far as your first question goes, no. As far as I recall, there actually has been no discussion to, in some ways, parallel that decreased funding scenario. Bill?
I'm sorry, can I recap on the question, please?
So you know how we have the decreased funding. You take the first 10% of the reduction out of the service categories that would be covered under essential benefits. For an increased, I had asked if, and because I couldn't remember if we had ever had a discussion about putting a certain percentage of any increase of funding into the service categories that aren't a part of the essential health benefits. And then, but my question really to you was, is that just a kind of a fiscal nightmare that's really not worth the change in whatever potential little amount that it just wouldn't be worth doing?
Okay, I'll take a stab at all of those. So in the past, in the long ago days, we actually did have increased funding scenarios, but that was mostly we had more optimism before the waiver came into existence about 7 years ago. It's been year after year of cut. And, you know, as this is increasingly formula based, the top line dollar stays flat. You know, it seems highly unrealistic and more of an intellectual exercise. So I think that's the first part of it. You guys do generally kind of punt if there were an increase to the happy case where that was the case that we actually had an increase in funding, at which point you would convene at the meeting to decide. And you are right that if it's a very small increase, probably better that it doesn't go across the systems because it's opening a zillion contracts for very little money.
Yeah.
We have a lot of money, a different story, but you guys hold the right to revisit allocation throughout the year.
Well, so that would be, so to your last point there, it actually would be better, and like you said, it's almost a moot point, but it would be better because with this motion or whatever, it would be opening every single service category because it would get dispensed proportionately across all service categories. Whereas if we took it and only put like certain percentage of it into only the non-essential benefit service categories, that would actually decrease the number of contracts that would get opened up and messed with.
That is true. And Matt, I think the working principle is that the advocacy from the from Happen and members of the Planning Council has historically for many years rendered that point not a painful thing we've had to implement because the funding gets restored, although it's not guaranteed every year. So yes.
But for increase, as I
Oh, I'm
think.
sorry, you were talking decrease or increase, Matt, there?
Increase.
Oh, increase. I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. Yes, if you were going to do increase, you did across the board, it'd be opening a zillion contracts. And then some agencies, we tend to give them the choice, like, is it worth the extra 3,000 or 4,000? And for some it is, and for many it's not. So what we would then do is we just put it back in the pie and give it to those agencies that feel that they can use it.
I guess, yeah.
So, but if
If
you're looking for a simpler thing, yes, I think if your question is if we did fewer, we could put more money into fewer contracts and maybe make a more appreciable difference with a larger amount of money. Is that like the question
yeah,
that
that's
was
what I
actually?
was
Yes,
thinking.
that would be the case if you all decided to do that. I don't think there's a way to go wrong, but certainly it's a lot of work for smaller dollar amounts.
Yeah.
But, for cost of doing business, a lot of agencies felt like it was worth it, the 4 or 5%. So
Yeah.
it's a mixed story there. Yeah.
I guess I was just thinking, and we're such small potatoes in San Mateo, the increases that we have gotten over the past few years, not just in any of our funding streams, we've passed on to the CBOs and not maintained any of it internally. And those tend to be the non-essential benefits service categories.
Yes, that certainly is a valid choice. I think, Matt, I think they're all good choices. So I think there's pros and cons. I think you're asking the right questions. But in terms of HIV health services, I don't have a particular recommendation. I think what we can do is talk pros and cons. So there certainly is, but in terms of how we would do it, we would go on what you guys recommended, and then we would approach agencies. And if the amount was too small, they say no, and then we just roll it back into a pot
Yeah.
so that it gets to be slightly more for each agency.
I guess I just feel like to make it, and again, this may it's a kind of a whole moot point discussion for the increased funding scenarios, but just to if that were to ever happen, it just seems like it really would be more meaningful if it wasn't just spreading pennies across multiple agencies and somehow making it really somewhat meaningful.
Yes.
Matt, would you like to? Oh, sorry, go on.
No, oh, go ahead, Mark. You guys are good.
Matt,
Yes,
would you
you're
like to form that as a motion? I can put the language in that pretty easily.
Well, I mean, I would like, instead of a motion, I would just, can we have a discussion? What are other people's thoughts? I don't want to. If other people are like, eh, it's not even worth it because, you know, we aren't going to see an increase in everything, then I'm fine. It literally just popped into my brain because I thought, well, that's interesting. It's like, it's not bookended. If you look at, you know, increase, usually you'd have the same just reverse on increase and decrease and then.
I appreciate this being brought up for discussion, and I think I'm following correctly, Matt. I mean, in my mind, yeah, I would be like, why can't we fill the ones we just cut, right, first? But then I also understand where Bill's coming from, that proportionally, if we increase all, then everyone gets the increase. So I'm kind of more so with keeping it the way it is, just because it's so small. Would it make really a difference? And I would like to see everyone proportionally increase rather than just one or two, but that's my opinion.
I'm not making this a motion. I'm just spelling it out to make sure we all can see what Matt might be talking about.
And I'm just bringing it up for discussion. Like, yeah, I think it's a good point to discuss.
Because usually the agencies that are providing the services that are not part of an essential benefits package, they're not getting reimbursed potentially through any other like Medi-Cal or health plan situation, whereas the others could theoretically, those pennies aren't really going to mean anything to them. And it's extra work on DPH's side, it's extra work on everybody's side, so that if at least those pennies were turned into dimes to the other agencies, which are usually CBOs, that's what my thought process was. And again, they're still dimes.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Theoretical dimes that probably aren't going to be there.
Yeah, I was even going to ask, like, do we see an increase? I mean, but it's good to think about. What are other
people? Well, I mean, the weird thing, like, for us is even though there was a decrease to Part A, San Mateo got an increase because of our proportionate number of cases that we're still living. And that happened when San Francisco kind of caught up with CDPH numbers and everything.
We did see an increase not too long ago, right, Bill? I forget. It wasn't that a huge yes. increase.
But yeah, it was a small Part A increase.
Yeah, so it is a possibility. I used to think of it as a pure like conjecture, a fantasy, but it has actually occurred.
I
don't know. I guess
Mark, just I don't want people to get overly hopeful. I think that had to do a lot with COVID money and the Absolutely. Way stuff moved there. I think that's
yeah.
I would love to think of a larger money, but you guys may remember from the report, I can't remember whether Maria or I gave it. You know, it's formula, most of it's formula driven, even the non-formula part of this we're discovering. And yeah. So we're looking at another 1.5 decrease on the formula side of our funding. So we'd have to make that up on the competitive side of the funding. So I don't mean to be totally pessimistic because I did just come back for vacation. It seems not so likely till they grow the pie.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. No, I appreciate that. What are other people's thoughts we haven't heard from? I'd be interested to hear your opinion as co-chair.
Yeah, I think the possible motion makes sense to spread it out across the CBOs and the other agencies so that they can kind of see a little bit more of a change. So I would support that. But I always feel more hesitant because, you know, this is talking about San Francisco's CBOs and not Marin County. So that's why, yeah, I would also lean on the folks who are from San Francisco and kind of their preferences as the providers.
Sure.
And clients.
Other people's thoughts? It sounds like we do have support for Matt to make a motion if he would feel comfortable.
So the way you have it there, Mark, and this is where when I was first just thinking of it, it was like bookending. But I think that this actually makes more sense. Bookending meaning that, you know, still having like, oh, the first 10% of increase would go. But then that just becomes a fiscal nightmare, I think, of everything. And it doesn't really solve the problem or solve the issue of a lot spread out over for little pennies. So I actually like that better than my initial thought. Am I making a motion? This is my last prioritization allocation. So
it could just be a discussion.
Go ahead and make a motion.
Okay.
But again, I would agree with Na's point that I'm San Mateo. I would like to hear the thoughts more from San Francisco. And I know we don't have a ton on here, but yeah.
So I just I'm gonna reframe the question so I end.
Thomas, before you go, there is a half of a motion on the floor. Is there a second to this motion before we begin the discussion of a motion on the floor?
I'll
And
second.
I get
All
to
right.
make motions since we got our letter today.
Absolutely. The renewal candidates did there, unfortunately. The new members have yet to receive theirs.
Oh.
Yes. Thomas?
So we were talking about two different things, is what I'm understanding, right? So one was this, if there's a small amount of increase or even decrease, that do we spread that across everybody, and the administrative burden of doing that would be high. And then we were also talking about just what Matt, I'm hearing you say bookending to make sure that this document reflects both an increase and a decrease possibilities. Is that right? No.
Can I step in? You got that almost right. So the first part certainly is correct as far as reducing administrative burden by actually reducing the number of service categories and therefore service providers that would be impacted by an increase.
Increase.
You got part of the bookending correct, but not completely. The bookending here is actually using the same logic that was applied last year for the decreased funding, in that in which those service categories and therefore service agencies that do receive other robust funding streams are actually touched a little bit more for decreased funding. And so the logic being to bookend that, therefore the ones that do not have other sources of funding would be touched more by this increased funding, and therefore the impact would be greater. And it would equal the logic of the decreased funding scenario from
Yeah.
last
But it wouldn't, but I did not include the 10% piece in the increase because that just would still, it wouldn't resolve the problem
Yep.
of
Highly
just.
unlikely we get an over 10%
Yeah.
increase anyway.
Yeah.
Thomas, you had another question?
Yeah, that sounds how do you operationalize the question of somebody gets funding from a different source? Is there a Does
There's a
that mean?
non-essential, the essential health benefits package.
So you can see below here. I don't know if you can actually see it here. Let
Yeah,
me.
you got to scroll a little, Mark.
I'll scroll down. There are specific service categories where remuneration can actually take place outside of Ryan White Part A. And those are primary medical care, mental health services, pharmaceuticals, which, as you all know, is no longer a service category. So I'll have to update that. Medical case management, substance abuse counseling, and dental slash oral health. So all of those are categories covered under our EHB. And therefore, if there are reductions in those areas, they can be easily made up by using other funding streams.
Great. Thank you.
Any further discussion on the motion on the floor? All right. Keeping in mind the regretfully that we still have yet to receive
So are the
appointment
only
letters for
voting
new members.
members?
Right now, there are currently four voting members. Bill does not vote, and unfortunately, Elise is one of the new crop of members who is unable to vote until she has received her appointment letter. So that will be four folks, and therefore, for this to pass, it would require three people in the affirmative. And so, with that said, we'll do a roll call vote because this does involve money. Matt Geltmaker.
Can I skip for right now since I made the motion? Well, I might as well say yes, I guess, since I made the motion. And if it fails, it fails. I'm fine with that.
Nali.
Yes.
Manuel Vasquez.
Yes.
Thomas Noble.
I will abstain. So that, thank you, Matt, for changing your vote. That
All right,
works.
Harry's, this will now move to the next committee. Now let's go to the statistically improbable scenario of exactly flat funding. Last year's resource allocation scenario for flat funding was pretty much as straightforward can get. If funding remains at the current level, service category resource allocation will remain level across all categories. Discussion or motions?
I motion to keep that same one.
Is there a second to that?
I second.
Discussion of the motion on the floor. All right, seeing no discussion, we'll go in How about the reverse order? Thomas Noble.
Dane.
Manuel Vasquez.
Yes.
Nali.
Yes.
Matt Giltmaker.
Yes.
Motion passes, and we'll continue on to the next committee meeting. And finally, the most likely scenario for the San Francisco EMA, the decreased funding scenario. Last year, the council decided to put this motion forward. It's actually a motion that has seen its way at a number of allocation meetings. There's been some shifts over the years, a little bit here and there. I think this one has stayed pretty steady for the past couple of years, at least. So last year, the motion that was passed was, in the event of decreased funding for the first 10% of reductions, allocation for services that are covered under California's Essential Health Benefits Package, as seen below, will be reduced proportionately. If further reduced allocation is required, reductions will occur proportionally across all service categories. So you, what you see here is a graduated motion depending on how much a cut would be. So if it's up to 10%, we see here that the cut will come entirely from those service categories that are potentially able to get remuneration, not potentially, will be able to get remuneration through California's EHB. However, if the decrease is over 10%, then it's a share the pain across all service categories proportionally type scenario. Any questions on last year's decreased funding scenario? All right, discussion is now open for discussion or motions.
I motion to move ahead.
All right. And Matt seconds this. Any discussion on the motion that is now on the floor? Seeing no discussion, we'll do another roll call vote. Manuel Vasquez.
Yes.
Nali.
Yes.
Thomas Noble.
Abstain.
Matt Geltmaker.
Yes.
All right. So we'll see here that we have two returning motions and one updated motion. And this will basically go as is. Where's my strikeout? I'll do that later, I guess. As is to tomorrow's meeting. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Okay. Was that everything for the resource allocation, Mark?
Yes. Okay.
Thomas, your hand's raised.
Can I ask just kind of a, I don't know what how to frame the question, but Mark, if somebody's in multiple meetings over this conversation, does that, what's the guidance, for lack of a better word? Should the person just abstain in the other spaces, or
that's, you know, entirely, what I mean? That's entirely up to that person. All council members are able to go to all committee meetings, including steering, and able to add their voice and vote. The only difference is being, if you're not a member of that committee, you cannot, a motion cannot be moved and seconded by non-members. Other than that, you can just follow your own personal value system.
Thank you. Bill, your hand's raised.
Yeah, just kind of a heads up for the retreat. I think, Mark, you guys may have discussed it briefly, but some of the feedback that we got at our recent site visit is that we have conflated a model being a COE with a service category. And so it ended up being a combination of 3-4. Did you guys already discuss that already, Mark? Did people feel clear?
Yeah, I discussed that at the full council meeting when I went over the prioritization sheets.
Okay. So I think what we'll do, unless you all have a different recommendation, is we're going to kind of make a way to make it more simply and digestible. And what we'll do, we'll give you the breakdown of the COE by the service category, and then probably add it into each service category. And then you guys can two votes, one for the service category and two to use it for the COE model. But I'm going to let me talk a little bit about it with John, and then I'll come back to you guys and get a sense of what he thinks is going to make it easier for him for reporting and stuff.
Okay, great. Okay, well, thank you so much, Sharon Pipkin, for your patience. We will turn it over to you for the HIV epidemiology update.
Thanks, everyone. So the Council Affairs Committee should have received a slide deck maybe a couple business days ago. And I'm going to show you those slides on my screen today. I would like to mention that there's a couple of places where I might have changed the order just for readability and understanding. So I'm going to go ahead and share my screen now. Hold on, hold on. Is the group seeing slides from a PowerPoint?
Yes.
Great. Okay. So I'm going to run through these slides pretty quickly in the about 20 minutes that Mark gave me because several of the slides in this deck contain data from last year's presentation. The reason is because the latest HIV epidemiology annual report has not been published yet, but it will be by the time we have the full council meeting. So there's plenty of slides in the slide deck that are more or less placeholders and opportunities to generate a discussion in this group, whether that's the same content that you'd like to see this year. So today's slide deck is for the Council Affairs Committee, and our outline today includes new diagnosis trends and a discussion of several focus populations, some carried over from last year, including persons experiencing homelessness within San Francisco, as well as Latina X persons. We'll also look at persons living with HIV, with some attention to the growing proportion of people who are in the older age groups of 50 years and older and 60 years and older. We'll discuss the HIV care continuum for new diagnoses and persons living with HIV. And I'd like to, just like last year, show you several national HIV/AIDS indicators that are measured by Medical Monitoring Project, which is a supplemental surveillance project. And finally, we'll look at trends in HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis. Most of this is last year's data, but I'll let you know what we have to look forward to this year. And Manuel or Mark, if you want to, if anyone wants to interrupt me, I can't see on
I'll
my
watch.
screen. Yes.
Sure,
Thank
I'll watch, Sharon. Thank
you.
you.
So this slide again is very familiar to the group. We are now looking at new diagnoses, deaths, and prevalence starting from the year 2006 through 2023. Most of the data that I have up here is from our is preliminary from our semi-annual report. The things I'd like to point out include looking at the red line of new HIV diagnoses in 2023. We are seeing a decline from 167 initial HIV diagnoses last year to 132 in 2023. And that's equivalent to about a 20% decline a year compared to 2022. Next, I'd like to point out the trend in annual deaths. And the most recent year we have complete data for is in 2022. You can see that deaths continue to trend upwards slightly. And in 2022, we're at 318 deaths. This is attributed primarily to a growing proportion of people who are, really aged in our cohort here in San Francisco. So finally, we have represented by these purple bars, people living with HIV. So in 2023, about still 15,500 people. When we look at people that are receiving care in San Francisco, and I put up here 2022 numbers, that number is about 11,500 people. So receiving care in San Francisco is a different population. And when we look at that population broken down, about 79% are living in San Francisco, while 21% are living outside San Francisco. We're going to transition to looking at, this is again preliminary data by gender, and we're looking at diagnosis trends for the last 10 years, starting in 2014. When I say preliminary data, I don't have all of the transmission categories up, but what I'd like to point out is for MSM and MSM who inject drugs. So MSM who do not inject drugs are represented by the yellow line, while those who do inject drugs are represented by this purplish line. And in the most recent year, we're seeing a decline from the previous year to 91 persons who were MSM diagnosed in 2023. And then for those MSM who inject drugs, it is fairly flat compared to the previous year and to and also to the year 2020. When we look at trends for cis women, again, this line here, I've only included in the preliminary data what total diagnoses for cis women were by year. And what you can see is, over the last 10 years, kind of this rise in 2015 to 2017, these numbers are small, so it really does fluctuate quite a bit. But for the most recent 2 years, the number of cis women diagnoses appears to be pretty pretty level. And then next, we are looking at diagnosis trends among trans women for the last 10 years. Again, we're looking at very small annual numbers, and there's quite a bit of bouncing around in this trend line, with the last 2 years a pretty level again in terms of annual diagnoses, with 11 trans women diagnosed in 2023. By race and ethnicity, we're seeing some interesting things in terms of declining numbers, and also for at least the 1 year. So we've been saying that, over time, the white and Latinx groups have been trending more closely together. Starting in 2017, whites here are represented by the yellow line and Latinx persons by this light green line. So you can see that these lines are trending closely together, with Latinx persons being the most frequent in number starting in 2018. And in 2023, we're seeing that come down to 40 diagnoses in 2023. So there again, the trend is saying that at least for that year, the numbers of diagnoses were closer between whites and Latinx persons. And the third most frequent group is Black African Americans, represented by this light blue line. By age, what's been persistent for the last decade is the most frequent by age group in new diagnosis each year is the 30 to 39 age group, that's represented by the green line. compared to the previous year, it was pretty fairly level. And then you'll see that there's the remaining age groups here. The yellow line represents youth and young adults, and that remains fairly low numbers of diagnoses. Starting with in 2020, you can really see that decline compared to 2018. When we look at persons newly diagnosed who are age 50 years and older, we're seeing last year's data, so 2023 is incomplete, but this trend is, in terms of numbers, is going to be, similar to 2022, and going to see maybe a very similar percentage that people 50 years and older accounts for in 2023 diagnoses. Moving to new diagnosis data on persons experiencing homelessness. Again, this we don't show 2023 here. Last year we saw somewhat of a decline in percentage, and 28 persons experiencing homelessness diagnosed last year, and we're expecting this to perhaps the proportion of people experiencing homelessness rise a little bit, because our overall diagnoses for 2023, the overall number has come down quite a bit, and we're also expecting to see level similar numbers of in terms of persons, the absolute number of persons experiencing homelessness in 2023. Well, this is last year's data again, so the trend is not changed dramatically when we move forward by 1 year to 2023, meaning that this second column shows persons experiencing homelessness who are newly diagnosed compared to those who are not experiencing homelessness newly diagnosed. And again, the pattern is going to show that a greater number of women and trans women were represented among the homeless group, as well as persons who inject drugs will be overrepresented in the homeless group. Last year's report to the full council, we included specific slides focusing on Latinx persons, and this does not contain new data yet, but this data shows, again, broken down by age group. It's pretty consistent with what we see for age group analyses for all persons diagnosed, in that the 30 to 39 year old group is the most frequent. There's some very slight increases in other groups, like the 25 to 29 young adults, 40 to 49. What is most noticeable is, again, the 30 to 39 year olds. For health insurance and access program data, this again is last year's data, and what we're expecting to see for 2023 is maybe some very marginal increase in the percentage of new diagnoses who had any insurance. Again, some of this proportional trend is probably due to the decrease in the overall number of people diagnosed. And we are expecting to see similar patterns in the by racial ethnic group. Latinx persons will be the largest group that does not have any insurance at the time of diagnosis. And so these are just some observations. They're not complete because we weren't able to see all of the data in today's slides, and a lot of it will be updated. But the total diagnoses decreased in 2023 by about 21% if you round up compared to 2022. And decline in diagnoses among cis men are primarily driving the decrease. Men who have sex with men who inject drugs were stable, while men who have sex with men who do not inject drugs decreased by 22%. Overall diagnoses for cis women decreased since 2015, but is pretty stable compared to the last year, 2022. And the proportion of diagnoses who are 50 years and older also declining starting in the year 2020. And here we're expecting to say that persons who experience homelessness accounted for a slightly higher proportion of 2023 diagnoses compared to 2022. Now we'll move into the section where we look at persons living with HIV, and we're going to look at some data that's separated by gender and by age. Here we're looking at cis men by age group. So across the horizontal axis are different racial ethnic groups, and then we've plotted the distribution by their age as of December of 2023. For men, we know white men, whites make up overwhelmingly a large proportion, and followed by Latinos. And you can see that by these yellow bars that we've labeled the data points for 60 persons 60 years and older, that for whites and Black African Americans, that is the group that is the most frequent by racial ethnic group. And then where that starts to differ is among Latinos and Asian Pacific Islanders, where among Latinos, the curve is skewed towards older folks, 50 to 59 and 60 years and over. But these last two age groups are fairly similar, and also a different distribution here. I meant Asian Pacific Islanders who are men, those 50 to 59 are the most frequent group for persons living. This, when we look at cis women, persons living with HIV, the distribution is really quite different. So among women, we can see that Black African Americans really are the largest group of women living with HIV, followed by whites, and then closely also by Latinas. After that discussion of looking at persons living with HIV by racial ethnic group and age, we're going to pivot to looking at the HIV care continuum. So here we're looking at, again, last year's data, but you'll be able to see 5 years worth of data of new diagnoses and how well the city has, how well we've done to link people to care, retain them into care, which is this third group of bars, and then help them to be virally suppressed within 6 months and also 12 months. What I've done here just fit some understanding of what's been happening for the recent periods. This is from our preliminary semi-annual report. And it's structured a little bit differently across the horizontal axis, we're looking at new diagnoses in 6 month periods of time, ending with June of 2023. But we're able to see your new diagnoses represented by the blue bars, the orange bars being linked to care within 1 month, and then finally, viral suppression within 6 months. So for these first two groups, which cover 2022, the viral suppression is pretty similar, 81% and 78%. You'll see that kind of average out. And then for the first 6 months of 2023, we're seeing viral suppression at 6 months, 79% of people were virally suppressed at six months. However, just a reminder that this is only for the first half of the year, so we'll be able to show you the full year's data. And again, here, this is last year's information, but in 2023, we're expecting to see, very similar proportions of people living with HIV that were virally suppressed in this year of 2023. I'd like to show you a couple of national HIV AIDS indicators that calculated from the Medical Monitoring Project, this time for people who were recruited to participate from 2015 through 2022. And this slide is showing the viral suppression in the prior 12 months before the person was interviewed for the project. And we show two indicators. The first, this lighter row being that their most recent viral load was suppressed. And then this bottom row is that all of their viral load measurements that we documented from medical chart review were suppressed. So this is, this is pretty important in that of people who are in care, which is what Medical Monitoring Project shows, 80% of participants in these cycles, their most recently engagement with medical care, they were virally suppressed. And then moreover, 75% of them were consistently virally suppressed amongst all the medical records that we reviewed and documented. This table here shows unstable housing, unemployment, hunger, and food insecurity during the 12 months before interview. Among persons with diagnosed HIV. Here in the first column, this is the cycle year of MMP, and this is updated information. What we're able to show you is in this second column for unstable housing, there is some small decline in the percentage of participants who were unstably housed or homeless compared to the previous cycle, 2021. For unemployment, that indicator or measurement has bounced around quite a bit for each cycle. So it's not dissimilar to previous cycles, but in 2022, unemployment was measured at 15.1%. And then food insecurity, again, there was a decline, and one can say, declining across, 2021 and 2022. So about 14% of participants reported hunger, food insecurity. And then again, for Medical Monitoring Project, here we're looking at unmet needs for mental health services during the 12 months before interview. And 2022 is the newest data that we've added. It does seem that compared to the previous cycle, the proportion of people reporting that they had unmet needs for mental health services increased to 25%. In this last part of the presentation, we're going to look at data for pre-exposure prophylaxis among people who are HIV negative. And we're going to show you data from San Francisco City Clinic. This is last year's data, so I'm not going to highlight anything too different. But we will also be looking at San Francisco City Clinic's data that's displayed by PrEP and PrEP regimen. So, what type of regimen did people elect to use when they enrolled on PrEP? And this year, we will be able to show you PrEP regimen, including long acting injectable PrEP or cabotegravir. So that's going to be something to discuss and look at closely. And then finally, our semi-annual report is already published and released. That's what a lot of the data that went into today's report is from. And then for the full council meeting, we'll have data from the 2023 HIV Epi report. So I'm going to stop sharing right now and then have some time for discussion and questions, and then you can recall back to slides that you'd like to see, or we're going to, talk about content to add.
Thanks so much, Sharon. We do have Matt Geltmaker. Your hand is raised.
Hey, Sharon, thanks. So I have a question way back on slide three. So you have this, it's over on the right-hand side, where you, so, and I get it, this is 2022 data, but so in 2022, there were 15,604 living in San Francisco. And then you have the last bullet point, 11,579 received care, and only 75% of those were people in San Francisco. So if you take 79% of 11,500, you're only getting like 9,000. So can you say anything about if 9,000 are getting care, what are the other 5,000 doing it? And I have a feeling I kind of know some answers to that, but I'm just curious, because if we were to do the same thing in San Mateo, I would want to be able to find that again. So I'm curious your thoughts.
Yeah. So again, the 15,000 number are people who were diagnosed with HIV in San when they were living in San
Living.
Francisco. So we put that number there, but it's not reflective of all the folks the folks that are receiving care in the most recent time period. So that's where I draw your attention over to the bullet that says 11,500. Those are the people we know they're currently getting care in San Francisco. They may not, and again, the breakdown shows you they're not all living in San Francisco, and they were not all diagnosed in San Francisco either.
So this is where I've had to explain a lot of times to people that EHAR's data, even though it says, whatever, 15,000 or whatever living in San Francisco, that's at time of diagnosis and it's not getting updated. So there's the coming and the going and the everything. So that's what I'm always trying to describe when people are asking me about San Mateo County data. So that's what I'm assuming you're saying as well.
Yeah, and it's and that 15,000 number is a it's a much more crude measurement about who is still alive when as of all the people who were diagnosed in San Francisco. It's a crude measurement because we're not reflecting the in and the out migration. It's just reflecting the adding the new diagnoses, which is that red line number, and then subtracting people who know that have died.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, that was my assumption, and I just wanted to make sure when I'm talking about our numbers, it's I'm kind of mirroring what you're saying too. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Great question, Matt. Bill Bloom, your hand's raised, and then we'll go to Thomas.
Yeah, hi, Sharon. Great presentation. Good to see you again visually. It feels like it's been too long. A couple of thoughts or suggestions. You may want to define a little bit for the newer planning council members just what EHARS is and what you do. And then similarly, the medical monitoring project, just what it is, when it started, just so people have some context. And helpful for us if you're able to say this data is everyone in San Francisco, which is different than what HHS provides to you, which is the ARIES data, which is people getting care.
Okay.
I'm guessing you also may get a lot of interest in people who are older and dying, particularly if you're saying it's advanced age. And so I think particularly if you have some breakdown on the top causes of death, and particularly if it's accidental overdose, because I know there were some studies coming out. I don't know if they're ready for prime time, but I think that might be of interest to the Planning Council. And you may, in terms of the insurance status, just underline that that's right at the moment of diagnosis, and that people who are not insured do get insurance. And that also with Medi-Cal expansion to include people, irregardless of their immigratory status, to the extent that Latinx are overrepresented in that group, we would expect to see that gap narrow in the next year or so, because this is, of course, data going back a year.
Yeah, thanks.
Great. Thomas, your hand's raised. You're on mute.
Thanks, Manuel. That's a great presentation. I always appreciate it. And I know you said placeholders. A lot of the slides were placeholders. So anything that just had 22, year 22, and didn't have 23, you're going to add to the 23. It'll have 23.
Correct, except
Okay.
for medical monitoring project, which is like a year behind basically, because of the complex analysis and waiting that needs to be done. So the medical monitoring stuff is already the most recent that we have available.
Cool. And then the other thing was just the 50 and older being diagnosed slide. I keep thinking about the baby boomers. And I'm like, so if that particular percentage of the population, if the population has gotten older, we could assume that the number of people acquiring HIV would get older. Does that make sense?
Well, except we're also the other age data does not entirely bear that out. So you're correct in saying that there is this really accelerated growth of older people in the population, but in terms of new diagnoses, pretty consistently for the 10-year period, we're seeing transmission or HIV acquisition amongst people 30 to 39 years old being the largest group in San Francisco. Now, we don't know who they acquired it from, what the ages of their partners were, but so simply having a larger a larger baby boomer population, I don't think is going to bear out that means more baby boomers are going to be diagnosed.
That's great. So that's helpful. So if anything, the fact that the baby boomer, I think it was the 50 plus slide you had. If anything, if that stayed level, it would actually show quote unquote a decrease, because there's more people that fall into that group percentage wise. And I hear what you're saying.
Baby boomers are 59 plus. You got the decade wrong there.
Sorry. I guess I'd put myself into the baby boomer category. I think what happens just for the council is sometimes they kind of see that aging cohort with people living with HIV, and that's one particular thing to respond to. And then there's this issue of people acquiring HIV who are older, and so those two things get a little bit muddled. So But now that we've talked it through, I understand what you're saying, and it's actually better news than I think I was actually initially interpreting. And you're saying that basically it's the age between 30 and 39 that consistently seems to be the highest rate of HIV acquisition year
Right.
to year.
Yeah. And also, it may not have translated well from the slides because of that missing year, missing 2023. But we're seeing that that the proportion of new diagnoses who are 50 years and older has been on the decline since starting in 2020. So I mean, really small declines, but and we're, you know, expecting to see that bear out or be level in 2023.
That might be helpful to highlight then, just to help with that clarity with the issues between the aging population of people living with HIV and the concept of people acquiring HIV. So
yeah,
okay.
I think once we put in the slides about that Bill suggested of the mortality data, we'll again be able to distinguish. We're mentioning the growing numbers of persons living because hey, look, they're not. Dying as they're surviving longer, they're not dying from HIV related causes. But deaths, you know, the absolute number of deaths is going up, not necessarily rates of deaths, but the absolute numbers are going up just because people are growing older and dying of age related things.
I think that comes up every year, is that question about what's a natural death and then what's a death that gets counted in as an HIV related death. I don't think
and
I
so,
can speak to that.
Yeah.
Personally.
And so we don't have that slide in here. We do have some discussions about in the report of breaking down at least by underlying cause of death, if it was, you know, like an infection or it was a stage three, you know, advanced AIDS related condition, or if we don't know that the death certificate just simply didn't say and simply said it's HIV related, but that's it. Bill, did you wanted to chime in on that?
Sure, not necessarily you want to add it, but I have seen, and I think from you guys, preventable deaths. So that might be, if you guys have that data, that may be a simple way to help the planning council parse it out without kind of getting into what's completely HIV versus HIV contributing.
Great. I just want to jump in real quick to be mindful of time. So Mark, I do think we have until 5, but our agenda says till 4:30. And we still have to go through your service summary sheets. This is all really helpful feedback, everyone. I think Sharon, if you don't mind, if we could just have them maybe email you if there are any other follow-ups. Mm-hmm. Okay, great, individually. Yeah.
And we'll do I'll do a summary of like, this is what I heard from committee members and yeah.
Okay, great. Well, we really appreciate you being here and it was really helpful information. Thanks.
Thanks, Sharon.
Thank you, Sharon.
Great. Okay, everyone. So just being mindful of time, I do want to move it forward to service summary sheets with Mark Molnar.
All right, this will be quick. This is the template. Basically, we have been using, I'm sorry, receiving this presentation for the past few years. It's an updated version of which actually might be updated further. John Ainsley provides this presentation. He could not make today's meeting. And so we'll be looking very briefly, actually, at last year's. I'm not going to go over each page by any means. It's a very long document. It's also a very useful document because it should literally answer any questions anyone might have about our service categories that are funded here in San Francisco. Under Ryan White Part A, a lot of utilization data, which is something that everyone should be taking in consideration when looking at the system of care and then making decisions. So I'll share screen. Can you all see that?
Yes.
All right. So again, this is not a new presentation. This is from last year, as you'll see. So the table of contents. So this will obviously, well, all of this should change. This is last year's prioritization. I'm sorry, it was not last year's. Actually, it looks like it's 2021. So John's 2024 presentation used the 2021 prioritization. And then some of the most useful and relevant is this next slide here, which actually does a breakout pie chart of all of the different ways that HIV care services are funding. It's a really great page, very important. Then we'll see here how much is being spent per service category within core services. As Bill has mentioned, as I mentioned at the last meeting, we'll see one of these disappear eventually. I'm not sure if this will disappear actually in John's upcoming presentation, because of course this is a snapshot of last year's. We'll see. And that would be Centers of Excellence. And then we see the same thing for support services, all color-coded. We can get some demographic information. Got one on age, housing status. Poverty level, insurance status. Race, ethnicity, gender, viral suppression. And then we get our list of EOS per service category, units of service, and UDC, unduplicated clients. So also useful because it shows how much is actually contracted, and then we actually show how much is provided. Some over, but most mainly under. All right, so we're actually going to wrap up this review with just reviewing this one slide. I'm not going to go through all of them. So this is a good example of what John provides across all the service categories. This is a review of mental health services provided via Ryan White in San Francisco. It shows a priority number. It has a definition of the service as well. And then it describes the different programs. So you'll see here there's multiple bullet points. Each bullet point is providing a snapshot of the different services available. We actually have a map of all of the different service providers and where they're located. Very useful.
Sorry, Mark, what are the red spots versus the blue spots on that? Do you know?
The red spots are where they are located.
Are there blue spots on there too? Are there just four?
I don't know what those blue spots are.
Yeah.
I don't think that that's something that John put in. It's just from a map.
Oh no, I think the blue spots are other. There are other programs that are not the program in that service category. So you can see the full array of all the services throughout the system. Okay. Now my eyesight is not great. I think that's what it is.
Bill, unless things like the Cable Car Museum are funded, then no.
Oh, okay. I'll ask. You may be right. My vision is not good. I'm up close and personal.
There also appears to be a service that's taking place in the ocean.
Oh, I guess not. Yeah.
All right, moving on.
We should guess.
We should fund the
ocean. It doesn't look, it's funny, the distribution is not dissimilar to where all the programs are.
Yeah. We should definitely be funding the ocean. All right, moving on to the second page. It shows distribution of Part A and Part B, general fund. We'll see here, for example, in mental health, we have the slight bulk is paid for via general fund. We'll see here like a quick encapsulation of the units of services, both contracted and provided, as well as an actual breakdown based on gender, race, ethnicity, and age. So, as you'll see, John does this for every single category. Poor John. That's a lot. It's really a mind-blowing amount of work.
Mark, I've watched him do it. He does it amazingly quickly, but it is a lot.
Well, good for you.
He moves super fast. It's like watching a magical spell.
I mean, I also just want to mention, like, along with the rest of most of HHS staff, he did have a week in DC, so I imagine this is possibly, even despite his speed, perhaps a current stressor for him to put together this mega presentation that literally explains the system of care to council members. And hopefully people do use the resource. We sent it out multiple times, orientation and for other matters. All right, I'm going to stop share here. So you saw it, and you saw what you've seen in the past. Any kind of changes to this template structure that you want me to report back to John?
I don't have anyone. I see some shaking heads. No. Maria?
I have one quick question. I don't know can I add that now or wait till everyone says they're... I was just wondering if with the new structuring of the service categories, if he should remove the categories that are not funded by Part A or just include them as FYI, if maybe they are funded by general fund, or if that should be, updated.
So Maria, I think that the service summary sheets only include service categories funded by Ryan White Part A. Am I wrong there, Bill?
I think we've had some discussion, and I'll check with him because I'm just back from 2 weeks. We also had some discussion about also sharing EIP service categories, but today's my first day back. I'll have better information later. I think what we're hopeful for you guys to see the area that you're prioritizing, the area you're providing guidance on, and what's an FYI. So for instance, EIP is not part of the purview of the council. For general fund, we are trying to have you guys prioritize them all, but you're kind of more of in a guidance role. And then for the Part A, you guys are the determiners.
Great. Okay. Any more discussion? No? Okay. That's it, Mark, right?
That's it.
Great. Our last item on the agenda is next meeting date and agenda items. So the next Council Affairs Committee is scheduled for October 8th from 3 to 4:30 p.m. If nothing else, I adjourn today's meeting. Thanks, everyone.
Mark and Kira, could you guys both hold on for a quick minute with Maria and I to ask you guys a question about the letters for renewals?
Kat, can you stay on too? Because I'm going to want to meet with you and Kira just briefly after we meet with Bill.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Manuel.
Bye, everyone. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Manuel.